Can we go now down to page 48, Nibbana through Anapanasati? That's 48, I've got there, it may have a different format. Let's see what you have there. No, it's just good, yeah. You've gone too far, so. 47. What does it say there? That's right there. There, we have it. JCS, right, MN, 118. Now that's, the text is quite small, that's better, yeah. Okay, so today we have got no sun to go in our eyes. Yay! Thank you for Christina for arranging some blinds. There weren't any on the windows, but she put them on the sun. Which is much better. So, can you all see easily enough? So, this is the sutta class for today. And it's Nibbana through Anapanasati. It's going to start off where we just discussed very briefly yesterday how to meditate on the breath, but it's going to go far deeper. And there's a few things in this description of the mindfulness of the breathing which I will just focus on. So, you know, we start off, this is a whole sutta here, the Anapanasati Sutta, and it starts off with the Buddha saying, so when mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is of great fruit and great benefit. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it completes the four focuses of mindfulness, that's the Satipatthana. And when the four focuses of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, they complete the seven enlightenment factors. When the seven enlightenment factors are developed, they complete true knowledge and deliverance. So anyway, that's the introduction. And how does mindfulness of breathing, developed and cultivated, complete the four focuses of mindfulness? And first of all, you just pause to make the point that you may have been to some meditation retreats and they try to make a distinction between satipatthana, which they call vipassana, and mindfulness of breathing, which they call samatha, as if the two were different. And here straight away you see the Buddha saying that mindfulness of breathing completes satipatthana. In other words, mindfulness of breathing is satipatthana. There's no difference there. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it completes the four focuses of mindfulness. That's the second sentence there. So you get two for one, both samatha and vipassana, when doing the breathing meditation. There's no difference between them. And it's not just samatha and vipassana. Here I go with Ajahn Brahm's commentary. It's also other things you bring in as well, like kindness. So once upon a time, there was this couple, Sam and Vi, and their full names were Sam Atta and Vi Passana. They weren't married, or if they were married, they never changed their surnames. And one day after lunch, they decided, it was a beautiful afternoon, to go for a walk up Meditation Mountain. Now Sam went up Meditation Mountain because it was so peaceful and still up Meditation Mountain. And Vi, his partner, she wanted to go up there because she was a professional photographer. And she took not just one of these little iPhones, but this Canon with filters and all sorts of other gizmos, so she could take these amazing insight shots. Because at the top of Meditation Mountain, you could see everything. So, Vi went up there for the view, and Sam went up there for the peace. But they also had two dogs. One dog was called Metta, and the other dog, it was a long name, Anapanasati. And so, those two dogs, Metta and Anapana, they went up Meditation Mountain too. But you ask a dog, why do you want to go for that walk? The dog just wants to do it for fun. It doesn't have any goals when a dog goes up to go for a walk with you. They are far wiser. They go up there for the joy, the peace and the happiness, because that's what they like. So anyway, so Sam, Vi and their two dogs start walking up Meditation Mountain. And when they get even halfway up Meditation Mountain, ooh, it's so cool and peaceful up there. Sam is already delighted. Even though it's not at the top, it's still really peaceful and still. And Vi, his wife, she just can't resist the views even halfway up. You can see forever, it seems. You can see all those things which are usually hidden from human beings, being down in the plains and the lowlands, and now she can see just amazing insights. And Metta the dog, oh Metta, she's wagging her tail, very happy, because even halfway up Meditation Mountain is so much joy and happiness. And Anapana, Sati, the other dog, you can hardly find her. She's actually disappearing. And anyway, by the time they get up to the top of Meditation Mountain, ooh, that is incredibly still. Peace like you've never experienced before. Sam is so satisfied with the deep stillness on top of Meditation Mountain. But Sam has also got a pair of eyes. He can see forever. As for Vi, the photographs she takes from up there are just astounding. They just break all ideas and illusions of the nature of this world, because up there you can see unimpeded, you know, the nature of reality. So she's happy, but she can also feel the peace. Sometimes she doesn't even want to click the shutter of the camera because it disturbs, but only for a moment, the deep silence and stillness on top of Meditation Mountain. And as for Metta the dog, even Metta the dog, oh, have you ever seen a dog blissed out? Like running around in circles, just wagging its tail like it's going to fall off. Have you ever seen a dog who's just so, so happy? That was Metta the dog. Only silently. But even Metta the dog could feel the peace, the silence, so he didn't want to bark. And it's also, every now and again, Metta the dog, she just looked and gazed at the amazing sights in front of her two little doggy eyes. And as far as Anapanasati, the other dog, had vanished, could not be seen or discerned or perceived on top of Meditation Mountain. And the reason is because on top of Meditation Mountain, the peace, the insight, and what sometimes people leave out, the compassion and love and kindness, the bliss, they all coexist. But the breath has stopped and cannot be found. Such is the summit of Meditation Mountain. So it's not just Samatha or Vipassana or Metta, which is too often left out. They all come together on the top of Meditation Mountain. Okay, that's a quite neat simile, and I keep adding to it every now and again, because stories and similes, they're alive, they should grow, and add a bit on here, take a bit off there. Otherwise, you come and say, well, I heard that story before. You heard some of that story before, but you always add a little bit to make it a little bit more interesting. And anyway, so, how does mindfulness of breathing develop and cultivate and complete the four focuses of mindfulness? And we did this yesterday. Well, when in-breath and out-breath are long, you're aware that they are long. In-breath and out-breath are short, you're aware they are short. When you learn to experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out, when you learn to calm the breath as you breathe in and out, on those occasions you are mindful of the body, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose and mindful. Because in and out breathing, this is a very accurate, I had to be really accurate, it's a little bit word for word, because it's an important point which even monks argue about. In and out breathing is regarded by the Buddha as a body in the category of bodies. And I say that because the word they use here, please forgive me for being sort of scholastic here, but sometimes you must show that you understand what you're talking about. I'm not making these things up for myself. The third part, they experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out. The word is the body of the whole body, sabbakaya. You experience the whole body as you breathe in and out. And some monks teach that means you're breathing in and out and you can experience your whole physical body as you're breathing out. And if you just contemplate for a little bit, what does it mean experiencing your whole body as you breathe in and out? Are you experiencing your toes as you breathe in and out in this particular part of meditation, in your ears and your belly if you're hungry? It's the whole of the body. And it doesn't mean the whole of the physical body. The body is a word which we use even in English, like a body of evidence, a body of truth, a body of soldiers. It's a term which even in English, in Pali, and those two languages, you know, Indo-Aryan languages, they are sort of got so many similarities. Even some of the words are similar. For example, what is the word for a lazy young man in English? They call them a yob. Heard of like a yob? I remember hearing that anyway. It comes from yobana, which is a Pali word for youth. Or what about the word for someone who's very lucky? Where did that come from? It means from Lakshmi, as a Sanskrit form, the goddess of good fortune. There is just so many words in English which you can see derived, you know, from the Sanskrit roots. But in this particular case, the word body is used for any group of things. So here, when it says you're experiencing the whole body, it does not mean the physical body, it means the whole of the breath. And even the Buddha said, on this sutta, that the breathing is regarded by the Buddha as a body in the category of bodies. So just I labored that point just to make sure that when it says the third step of Anapanasati, you learn to experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out, it becomes quite clear. It doesn't mean you stop watching the breath and feel your body. It means your experience of the breath becomes so deep you can see from the very beginning of an in-breath to the end of the breath, the whole of the breath. And even the gap between the breaths, which is fascinating. And once you're pointing out that when the in-breath is finished, the out-breath is yet to begin, the out-breath is finished and the in-breath is yet to begin, you may notice sometimes that those are the points where the mind has an opportunity to wander off, because nothing is really going on. And many people don't know how to observe nothing. The pause, the in-between moments, the spaces in life. But it's a little meditation teacher's trick when we ask you to, which is the longest period between the end of an out-breath and beginning of an in-breath, or the end of an in-breath to the beginning of an out-breath? Which is longer? And it doesn't really matter which is longer or shorter. All it does, it gives you something to do, something to watch, some importance to give when the in-breath has stopped and the out-breath is yet to begin. So the mind has got less opportunity to wander away. So, first you watch the in-breath, if it's long or short, and then that's one and two, experience the whole of the breath from beginning of an in-breath to the end of an in-breath. And you can now see the similarities between this and your walking meditation, because as you're doing walking meditation, you start, left foot or right foot is moving, is it a long step or a short step, and then eventually you can feel the whole of one step from the beginning when it starts to rise off the floor and go forward and then go down, the whole of one step. You start watching. And then, number four, you learn to calm the breath as you breathe in and out. You learn to calm the breath. And how do you do that? Do you say, right breath, you be calm or else? Because otherwise, if you do things like that, you will find that your breath gets very agitated. I was a school teacher for 1 year, and if you make the kids afraid, yeah, they get tense and they obey what you ask them to do. But as soon as you turn your head around to write something on the board, then they misbehave. In other words, they're only performing or keeping the rules when they feel they're being observed. And when there's a lapse of mindfulness, the mind goes off. So, to calm the breath, how you calm the breath, it's just natural. If you are watching the whole of the breath from beginning to the end, there's not much excitement going on. You're not doing very much. Your brain does not need to metabolize so much as you do when you are thinking or working out a problem and pushing your brain to just work really hard. I think the figure was about 30% of the energy which you eat and consume goes to supporting the activity of the brain. If you look to the size of your brain and amount of energy it consumes, it's way out of proportion to anything else in your body. Your brain just takes up so much energy. So you can imagine what it's like when your brain gets so efficient. It's just, you're just breathing in and breathing out. It means that all the energy you eat in, it just, you don't need to metabolize so much. Your metabolism goes down. And of course that is one of my problems. Because I don't think enough. I don't worry. I'm not agitated. But all the stuff which I eat, it's got nowhere else to go. It just goes in here. If that was you, it'd just be going thinking, 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 thinking. And you wouldn't put on weight. That's another of my excuses. It's amazing when you're a monk, you have so many excuses, well, you put on weight. But anyway, but that's actually quite a true reason. If you don't think and worry, you don't actually use so much energy. So anyway, so when you learn to calm the breath as you breathe in and out, it happens quite naturally. Just breathing in and breathing out. Just like when you're walking meditation, after a while you do walk slowly because there's too much going on to walk fast. Which means you do calm down. It's just natural. When you're enjoying where you are, you don't want to rush off into the next moment. You go slowly and you calm down. And it's wonderful to see, to experience, that even so far on this retreat, despite what you think of your abilities or your lack of them, that you've calmed down immensely. Just by being here for a few days, not having any internet, not sort of talking that much, not having too much to do, It's amazing how people just calm down, even if they're not even meditating. Because the place just encourages you just to walk slowly, move slowly, even eat slowly. You're not in a rush. There's nowhere to go. So you just be here. So because of that, you're already calming down. So you learn how to calm the breath down. And it says, on those occasions, you are mindful of the body, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose and mindfulness, mindful, and in and out breathing is guided by the Buddha as a body in the category of bodies. Those who are on that occasion meditate or abide. It fulfills the first focus of mindfulness. You abide mindful of the body, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose, and mindful. So you are practicing the first Satipatthana when you do breath meditation, even the first part of breath meditation. Now, that's basic. Now we go into the juicy part. Start the juicy part of meditation. When you start to get some happiness and joy coming up, when the bliss starts to roll in. This is Anapanasati. They usually call it 16 steps. We had the first four. Now, 5, 6, 7, and 8. When you learn to experience joy as you breathe in and out, relax to the max. That's joyful. And that gets even more happy. When you learn to experience pleasure as you breathe in and out. Now, this is a technical point, but this is important. When you learn to experience a mental formation, this is for those of you who've done some studies of Pali Chitta Sankara, of Piti Sukha as you breathe in and out. When you learn to calm this mental formation of Piti Sukha as you breathe in and out, those are the stages of 5, 6, 7, and 8. This is when you're breathing in and out, and your breath starts to appear delightful. With this pity, it's like a joy and pleasure, bliss starts to arise. And pause there, because this is supposed to happen. This is what the Buddha said does happen. This is one of the reasons why people become monks and nuns. And they spend their holidays paying a lot of money to not have any dinner in the evening and to sit here without any TVs or entertainments and not being having the internet. And you go back home to your business and say, oh, where did you spend your holidays? I spent my holidays only having two meals a day, sitting on my bum for hours every day. And they said, you are mad, you are crazy. But then they look at the smile on your face and say, hey, there's something in this. Because they can see the result of it. So, what is happening? You start to enjoy the breath, breathing in, breathing out. Happy. So happy, I usually mention one of the litmus tests. And you probably may have seen this already, maybe I'm not sure yet how the retreat has gone. Sometimes, you're meditating here, and your breath is just so delightful, breathing in, breathing out. And you know it's 11 o'clock. It's your lunch time. And you know that maybe that if you don't get up now, the lunch will be gone by the time you get up from your seat. You have a choice. Knowing you have no lunch in the afternoon, no dinner in the evening, you're going to have to forego your meal, and I'm not going to eat. The joy is much better than eating. And you see people sitting here, knowing full well they're not going to eat for the rest of the day. And they're very happy with that. They don't want to, it's just too much fun. Enjoying the beautiful beginnings of deep meditation. So that is almost like, this is like really nice happiness. I can eat another day, this is just too nice. just meditating on your breath. Now, how can the breath be delightful? Where does that delight come from? And this is where I go off on a tangent, but a very important tangent, to understand how this meditation works. And this is knowing that because you're calming your mind down, because you're doing very, very little, the energies which usually go into the brain, which I've already mentioned, are all about thinking and doing and planning and worrying and controlling and fearing. That stops, or at least really calms down. You're hardly doing anything at all. Which means that the natural energies of your body start to flow into mindfulness, into knowing. Instead of being, you're cultivating knowing. Those two are so connected together, being and knowing. And later on you'll find out just how you, doing and knowing. So, here we are calming down all the doer. We're hardly doing anything at all. Physically, even mentally, not planning, not thinking, not complaining, that's all doing stuff. We're just knowing. And what happens? The knowing is the mindfulness. The doing is the will. Because we're just calming our mind down, we're not willing, we're not doing very much, all the energy goes into knowing. Your mindfulness starts to increase in its power. I know that I've been teaching this for years. In the mindfulness groups which you come across, they just teach mindfulness, having no regard to the fact there's many levels of mindfulness. There's ordinary mindfulness, and there's power mindfulness, and superpower mindfulness, and super duper power mindfulness. In other words, the mindfulness has so many different degrees of intensity. So, you know, everyone is mindful when they come here. They can see where the door is. But you know that when the mind really starts to wake up, it starts to get energy. Mindfulness takes the energy rather than doing takes the energy. Then your mindfulness gets empowered. It's like turning the lights up. You see more. You can hear more deeply. You can feel more intense sensations on the body. You're getting awake. There's so many lovely stories about what happens when you empower mindfulness because you don't do very much. Even, it was last rains retreat, when I always take 15 days in my cave just to meditate, and I just don't sort of worry at all about anything which happens in the monastery. I tell all the monks and everybody else, for 15 days I am not going to be the teacher or an abbot. If somebody says, oh, one of the monks has run away with one of the nuns, I say, well, just, I don't care. It's their karma, not mine. And I just, they never do that. They're great monks and great nuns, as you will find out when you go and visit the Dhammasara in a few days' time. But what you do, you don't disturb yourself with doing anything. When I have those 15 days by myself, it's my real holiday, then afterwards you get so empowered. You feel so alive and energized. And I recall, this was last year, after the retreat was finished, in the morning I came down for breakfast. And I just, you know, One of my favorite foods, I probably got this from when I was at university, was baked beans. You know, they come from a tin. You know that in Hong Kong that Jen would always try to find a place where he can get some baked beans for me. And I just was so mindful, I just picked up just one tiny baked bean and put it in my mouth and went, wow. I never ever in my life before tasted such a delicious baked bean, just a single one. Just the way, just the tomato sauce on the outside with a tiny bit of salt, but not too much, interacted with the texture of a baked bean. Because it was not hard, it was not soft, it just crumbled, it like melted in my mouth. And just the way that it was quite bland the taste, but the bean had taste to it, and how that interacted with the tomato, the sweet and sour taste of a tomato, and it was a taste explosion. I couldn't believe, did this really come from a can? Or did we invite Jamie Oliver or some other chef to make the beans that morning? Because it was absolutely out of this world. That was just one bean. And that's why that just one of the other reasons I like baked beans is because I chant for them every day. May all beans, especially baked ones, be happy and well in my stomach. So anyway, where did that come from? Because other times, the beans aren't delicious at all. It's the same can, the same product, only my mindfulness was so strong. You could pick up every flavor, every scent of that bean. And that's why it was just intense. This is what happens when your mind is very calm. You can see so much more than other people can. You can feel more deeply. One of the other experiences was when the first retreat I ever did was I was 19 years of age, and it was our Buddhist group in Cambridge. We hired a few boarding houses in Bateman Street, which was the bottom of Bateman Street is where the Cambridge Botanical Gardens, the back entrances. And you're allowed on this retreat to go for a walk 1 hour every morning before breakfast. And you can go wherever you wanted, just a bit of exercise. And I knew that area and I thought, what better place to go for a morning walk than the Botanical Gardens? But I never actually got past the entrance, even though the entrance was open. You could walk wherever you wanted, but when the first day, I was obviously getting really nice meditation from the beginning. The first day I got to the entranceway, and there at the entrance to the right. It's amazing your memories of these things, because it's such an important memory in my life of meditating. I can still remember it and just visualize it now. To the right was this clump of bamboo at the back entrance to the Cambridge Botanical Gardens. And you must all know that bamboo features in almost every classical Chinese watercolor. It is a sort of a tree which is sensuous and beautiful. It is not sort of rich, it's simple, slender. And it's got these muted colors, the yellows and the greens, it's not sort of intense and rough like, other plants and flowers are. And I saw that clump of bamboo and I just was transfixed by it. I could not take my eyes off it. And I was standing there staring at this most beautiful clump of bamboo I'd ever seen in my life. And I had enough sort of regard to what other people were doing when they passed me. There was a student just looking, still, gazing, like some drug-fueled young man. And I realized if I didn't do something, then somebody would call the police and take me away. That happens when you do meditation, you know. There's another little tangent here. In the monastery in England, where Ajahn Sumedho started, this monastery in Chithurst. And he had a disciple who was a clinical psychiatrist. Because, you know, she was interested in Buddhism and mindfulness and meditation as a means for her to cope with her stress and also maybe to help some of her clients, her patients. And because, you know, it was a very highly paid job, you know, she actually bought this big, almost like a mansion, so dilapidated, but in a village in West Sussex. And she did it up with the help of some of the monks to be, you know, be a little place you could do a weekend meditation retreat. And so some of the monks and lay people came for a weekend retreat. And in many countries, you know that when you go on a retreat, you wear white clothes. So all these retreatants wearing white clothes were in this house, which everybody in the village knew belonged to a psychiatrist who worked at the local institute for those with mental instabilities. And when these nosy English people, they looked through their windows, through the curtains, they think, what's going on? They saw all these people doing their walking meditation in the garden, wearing white, walking in a very unnatural way. And this actually happened, that one of the women in his village added one and one together and got three. She thought, my goodness, she's brought her patients back into our village for the weekend. And she rang the police. And the police cars came into the village, you know, with the vans to take these the escaped inmates of the local mental institution, you know, back to where they belonged. So they thought. Because they'd never seen anything like slow walking meditation before. They thought they were from the asylum. And imagine you trying to explain that to policemen when you're very peaceful and calm. No, I am meditating. In the van with you. So they had to explain what was really going on. But anyway, so what was going on? Oh yeah, the clump of bamboo. So when I was watching this clump of bamboo, you really had to, there's a bench close by, so I thought, yeah, that's what I should do, sit on the bench. Because when you're sitting on the bench, you can stare at anything and people won't really worry you. So I sat on the bench and just stared at the most beautiful clump of bamboo. It was about 50 minutes every morning. I just didn't have any exercise. Because the following morning I went straight back there, sat on the bench and just stared and explored. It was delightful. I never finished exploring that clump of bamboo. It was so delightful. And then the retreat finished, ended. Now go back to scholars and to university and all the social life and the studies and work. But then after a couple of weeks, I had a free afternoon. So I went on my bicycle and went to the entrance to the Cambridge Botanical Gardens, and I was really excited. And I go and see the most beautiful clump of bamboo in the world, and where's my beautiful clump of bamboo gone? This was bamboo planted in the English climate. It did not belong there. That was just so dry, thin, wasted, just anemic, miserable, the most unhealthy clump of bamboo I'd ever seen in my life. Where was the beautiful part gone? But that was a wonderful experience, because I realized the beauty was not in the bamboo. The beauty was from my mind, which was so powerful, which was so pure, doing meditation. Whatever you see, You can see so much amazing beauty in it. And that's actually, it's a wonderful trick which you learn when you're a meditator. You can look at this bamboo floor. You can see so much going on in there. Just a wonderful square inch of that floor. And if I really was irresponsible and didn't want to talk to you, I'd just stare at that and you could explore so many different colors of yellows and browns and golds. So many different ways that those colors interact. You can look at that for hours. Simply because your mind is, mindfulness is superpowered. It's got energy. And you find on this retreat, sometimes you can go and sit by the outside the dining room, just look at the flowers or the trees or the birds or the clouds, and it's beautiful. I should really warn you so you don't get disappointed. If maybe you go back to work and then you come here for the day and you sit there, and before I could sit for hours watching these clouds go past, and now it's boring. You can't see the beauty. Because the beauty comes from the stillness, the calmness. Because I'm calming you all down, and you're doing a lot to calm yourself down, this place and the food becomes delicious. The reason I'm saying this is because when you get peaceful and calm, your breath becomes delightful. This is where the pity and the sukha come from. When you learn to experience joys, you breathe in and out. When you learn to experience pleasures, you breathe in and out. It naturally comes when your mindfulness gets strong. And you'll all experience that from time to time. And so when it happens, it's wonderful, it's an important stage in the path. And afterwards, you can expect that if you have a nice meditation, your porridge in the morning will taste more delicious than you've ever tasted it before. Your dumplings, your baked bean or your toast, I don't know what you eat in the morning. You just put it in your mouth, savour it, enjoy it. It's the result of meditation, not the cook. And when you even have a cup of tea, you can taste the tea. Really taste it. Experience it fully. You can go out and it's the wind, and you can, the wind is just intense on your skin. You can feel it fully for a change. And it's always delightful to do that. So this is the, what they call the mental formation, how your mind, when it's empowered, can experience the senses. Your breath is beautiful, delightful. Even if many people have this experience, and that's why I talk about it, even at some of you that at this stage you're watching your breath, but you can still feel your body. And your body feels like there's ants crawling all over it. It's not unpleasant. It's just like it's alive. It's tingly. It's just the mindfulness of your physical feelings. The fifth sense, the sensations in your body are being amplified. And it's totally pleasant. Oh, this is really good. It's weird. Like, things just crawling all over my body. But pleasantly, like tingly, like... That's actually a sign that your mindfulness is getting very strong. Don't disturb it. The body will soon vanish after that. But it's what happens. The breath is delightful. Even walking meditation. You're lifting up your feet and people say, how boring can that be, just walking? You know, get a life, Ajahn Brahm. You know, there's lots of things to do in that world. As I said, when I was recently, just even in Toronto, I had, people gave me a couple of days, you know, free time, so I could, actually one day free time, so I could actually relax and get over some of the jet lag. And they said, do you want to go Niagara Falls? It was just literally just an hour by car away. And 1969, I went to the United States, and I wanted, that was on my, one of my things to do, go and see Niagara Falls. You know what happened in 1969? They turned the water off. Literally, they diverted the water because the falls, the rocks were degrading. They were doing renovations on a natural wonder. They were doing that. I couldn't believe that. I thought this was natural. Yeah, but you know, even nature things, they need to renovate them every now and again. So I never got to see it. I thought, oh, next time. But of course, I've never got to see it. Even I've had the opportunity to. But why? And what do you want to go and see a thing like that for? When you can just do some walking and you're lifting your feet. And, oh, that's so delightful. You're moving it forward. Now, you know me, you trust me, so I'm not crazy monk. If I said that to normal people, they'd think, you know, you really are sort of need your head examined big time. Just to have so much joy, just lifting a foot and moving it forward. But hopefully some of you have tasted some of that. You've touched it. You're just lifting, and there's so much going on in just one lifting of a foot. And it goes forward, you can feel it. It's calm, it's peaceful, the energy of your mind has started to really increase. The mind is empowering whatever you feel and see and hear. And what that means is you're really enjoying the meditation. The joy part starts to really build to the point that you're in this lovely little world of just watching your one step. And the similar experience I give was the first year as a monk. I used to do this walking meditation in the hall in Bangkok. It was so noisy outside in Wat Saket, in the middle of Bangkok, where I ordained as a monk. And I'd do my 1 hour walking meditation, and you soon got really into it. And then I was just watching the foot as it was moving up, incredible number of actually movements which you have to do just to lift the foot. And then I heard this weird sound, like from a distance. Brahma Wang So. Brahma Wang. It was weird. That was my name, but somebody was calling it from like 100 miles away. And then I stopped to consider, and I soon realized it wasn't 100 miles away. It was a monk who was shouting in my ear, trying to get attention, because I was supposed to go to a ceremony, to like a food offering, and I'd forgotten all about it. And my preceptor, the abbot, had sent this monk to come and get me. Fortunately, they know about meditation as monks. So again, they kept on shouting in my ear. But that's what it felt like. It's a long distance away. It's weird, but... And then I realized, oh yeah, I'd forgotten the appointment. So, this was absolutely true. No exaggeration. You know, to talk to someone, you had to go and get some eye contact to meet them, out of respect. So I had to turn my head to meet his gaze. And it took me a couple of minutes. It's amazing how many muscles you have to move to move your head from one place to another. And I knew it was a bit disrespectful, but it's the fastest I could do it. And eventually I met his gaze and said, what? Well, you are so cool. It takes a while for you to get things warmed up again and forget all the things working in proper order. Of course, it took about 5 or 10 minutes, but then I was back to normal mindfulness, so I could go fast. But at that time I was just beautifully stuck in this peaceful place. So now that's what happens. So mindfulness gets really strong. It's joyful. And here, please, if that happens here, just enjoy it. Make the most out of it. It's totally positive. And then you just go and watch your breath. Breathing in, breathing out. It gets really delightful. So you experience the piti sukha, the joy, the bliss as you're breathing it out. Just to calm, more like stabilize that. Anyway, I'm just going to go over this until the third part of Anapanasati. This is stages 9, 10, 11 and 12. And if you think you've just been blissing out already, you ain't seen nothing yet. Ooh, this is a really juicy part of meditation. When I say this, please understand that all that I explain in this is true, but if you want it, you will never get it. It comes by peaceful, calming the mind. And when you want something, you disturb the whole process. And you soon learn that, as I had to learn that. First time I got a deep meditation was as a layperson. Took 2 or 3 years to get back again because I wanted it. Ajahn Chah, brilliant teacher. We meditate to let go, not to attain things. Oh yeah, yeah. But I'm now going to attain the deep meditations. Just totally disrespectful and just not really understanding that this was a very great teacher. And so I wanted to do it my way. And it was the wrong way. And he was kept on telling me, look, you don't try and attain things. You let go. You're peaceful. And those things come to you like the donkey and the longan. That's how it works. So remember that when you sort of want to get these beautiful states which are coming next. This is the 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th stage of Anapanasati. When you learn to experience the jitta, this is the mind. What does that mean? Is that your 5 senses, the body, has been calmed down. You can't really hear at all. Just like I was saying, just if you do hear any sounds, it's like 100 miles away. And this beautiful little bubble inside. And you can't feel the body is just about vanished. And you already closed your eyes. Smells and tastes. You can't sort of smell or taste anything. And what you're left with is the 6th sense, your mind. And that's what they call the jitta. And as it usually appears, there's a nice beautiful light in the mind. And many of you have experienced those. You've got your eyes closed and see the lights in the mind. Interesting, it's more uncommon, but it does happen to people, that sometimes you're sitting there nice and peaceful, and you can smell fragrant scents. They're not in this room, like the scent of jasmine or something. You can smell it, but it's not here. And when that first happened, I thought, maybe there are really heavenly beings, they come and look after you. Because, they would always be very fragrant. But then it wasn't heavenly beings. It was just the way that your mind was becoming pure and beautiful. And you're experiencing this mind through your smell door, the sense of smell. It's not very common, and it's usually not very helpful, because when you see your mind as a beautiful light, there's more things you can do about that. That's the most usual way. And for those of you who think, oh, this is too much for me. This is my first meditation retreat. And Ajahn Bhav goes off talking about nimittas. I can't even watch my breath. Can't even sit still without thinking. But each one of you, every one of you, would experience that light one day. If not during meditation, when you die, you go, your 5 senses stop, and you go towards the light. Those people have near-death experiences, or remember what happens to them when they died the last time. They go towards the light. What the heck does that mean? Obviously, five senses get subdued, get turned off, and a beautiful light as the mind comes up. And I already talked to somebody about this on this retreat. For those of you who are interested, it was a beautiful, you know, quite an interesting little documentary on the book done by Anita Murujani. Because she was from Hong Kong, apparently. And many Hong Kongers are here. And she just, you know, terrible cancer. And just on the operating table, near-death experience, was floated towards the light and blissed out. She was a Catholic. And she interpreted that bliss as pure love, like a unity with the highest, like with a God. That's how she interpreted that. Good on her. And when she came out afterwards, blissed out, she came out with the insight. Remember, when you go to the top of Samadhi Mountain, you can see lots of important things. She realized the reason for her cancer was the stress of trying to please other people. She was really successful, a perfectionist. You think that you're so successful, you have enough, but successful people, perfectionists, always strive for more perfection. And that's why, seeing that with so many people, I say, stop trying to self-improve. You're good enough already. Relax to the max. And actually then you can improve even more. From that place of not stress. So anyway, that she realized that that was the cause of her cancer. And apparently, I remember seeing the little documentary, an interview, I think, with her, when it said that as soon as she was conscious, the first thing she said was, I'm cured. And she had tumors all over her and stuff in her, and all the operation stuff was, you know, tubes everywhere. And the doctor thought, you know, it's just hallucinating after this. But then she started to say things which the doctor says, you shouldn't have heard that. And of course, she was so confident. Yeah, I'm cured now. I've seen the reason for this cancer. And over the next few days or weeks or months, I forget how long, so all those tumors disappeared. And just a very healthy lady now. And I say that, she's not a Buddhist, but she understood just how to experience that beautiful light. You experience the jitter as you breathe in and out. You brighten the nimitta, because when it first comes up, it may not have enough oomph to it. It's like I say, superpower mindfulness. You just stay there, leave it alone, and it sucks up the energy. And it gets really bright and powerful. And when it does get really bright and powerful, don't be afraid. And don't be scared. It's one of my purposes of teaching this. Many people do get scared. The most powerful thing you've seen in your life so far. And it's you doing it. And you think, well, come on, not me. It's my first retreat. No, come off it, Ajahn Brahm. This can't be nimitta. It is. It's powerful. It's beautiful. And if no one has taught you about that before, people decide this can't be right. This lady in Penang, who, she also wasn't a Buddhist, but, I don't know what she was, but I didn't really care, that she had a psychosis, so she thought, and saw her GP, and he referred her to psychologists and psychiatrists. None of what they said made any sense. And it was just not knowing what had happened, which was an intense, powerful experience. And they thought, they didn't know what to do. Unfortunately, I go to Penang every year, and one person told another person, I always happen to be in town, go and see Ajahn Brahm, you never know. And so I made time to just sit down with her, and what happened? And then she told me what happened. And I smiled, and I said, no, madam, that was a jhana you experienced, totally out of the blue. you know, unexpected, not a meditator. She just, what I say, pushed the letting go button. And then I told her, now you've also experienced this, this, and that. And she said, yes! At last, somebody understands what I went through. I said, yeah, and it's very unlikely that you go back there again unless you start, you know, doing all the preparation work of just, you know, sitting on your bum for hours on end and learning how to let go properly. You know, you fluked it, but, you know, well done, and that was what it was. And she went away a very happy person. She wasn't mad. It wasn't a psychosis. She had a deep spiritual experience, which at last someone understood. And that really moved me, that experience, to actually to teach these things more and more, because it's amazing how many people actually either get close and see these beautiful nimittas, or even just go the whole way and just get into jhanas. And they just get so confused afterwards. That was big, that was amazing, but what was it? And what should be a cause for huge insights and joy and healing and a deep spiritual experience for many tend to be sort of a source of worry and concern because it's not understood. So that's why I teach like this. And of course, you know, it's amazing in my life just how many people actually experience these things. And even you. Isn't it wonderful? You can sit here and say, wow, me? Me too, yeah. Yes. But you can experience these things. I'm not saying you will experience these things. So don't come and complain after the fear. Ajahn Mahi, you said I can get a jhana or a nimitta, and I didn't. I want my money back, you fraud. The doors are open. But will you go through them? Or will you get scared and take control and mess it all up? Because those are the two main problems there. The fear and excitement, which happen. So really, just even recently, I think, where was that, over in San Francisco, I think, they were just saying, oh yeah, I just got really so close and then, yes. They're excited, it was happening, and they blew it. Because these are so sensitive states, you take any control, it just all goes wrong. Or other times people get afraid. Ooh, it's a bit too powerful for me. Be in good company. Because even the Buddha said, why should I be afraid of those states, which have nothing to do with attachment, stupidity or whatever. They haven't, but they're powerful. And of course, fear is an obvious thing which comes up when it's just so powerful. And you have to just let go full time, not full time, full on, to be able to handle one of those things. Perfectly safe, perfectly wonderful, but you just have to vanish, disappear, and not control these things. And you're wonderfully safe. So those are two things comes up. That's why it says, you brighten the nimitta, bring joy to the nimitta, and you settle the nimitta, you calm it down. Really what you're doing there, you're calming down all the excitement and the fear. Just being with it. And then you enter the jhanas. Real bliss. And the reason why you do those things is, when you come out afterwards, your mind is free from those five hindrances. Totally free. For hours. And that's, I don't mind telling you this. Because when somebody comes up to me, say Della comes up to me and she says, Ajahn Brahm, I just got into a jhana. I usually look at her and say, no, women can't get jhanas. Of course they can. I'm saying that just to see if she really has been in one. Because if she said, what? You can't say that. Ajahn Brahm was surprised at you. Then it's a test. Sorry, it wasn't a jhana. He said, okay, whatever. And she's blissed out, walking on air and just having a wonderful time. The smile on her face has not diminished. Okay, maybe it was. Because after you got into any of these states, you just cannot get upset for hours. You're just walking on air and just happy as anything, enjoying yourself. So it has the emotional afterglow for hours. Your five senses, your five hindrances of wanting, you're satisfied. You can't get upset. Your mind is poised. No sloth and torpor. So that's why, if you do get a jhana, if you get a jhana this afternoon, I'm sorry, but you won't be able to go to sleep at night. This night, you don't want to. Who wants to? Basically, you're perfectly healthy because you've got really beautiful energy inside. That's just what happens. And it's totally different than wanting to go to sleep and not being able to go to sleep. This is just your mind is empowered, and wow. Who wants to go to sleep when you've got so much joy and energy and power in you? But that's actually how this meditation works. And I'm saying this not because you think, not me. Too often, when I've taught meditation, I've dumbed it down. In other words, just taught ordinary meditation, just, be mindful, and just let go, and have a nice time. But that's disrespectful. Disrespectful of all the people in this room. Who knows? Maybe one day we'll get these beautiful limiters and bliss out. And who knows, you may remember, oh yeah, Jambam said this is fine, this is okay, this is what happens, let's go for this. And you won't resist. And have the time, not the time of your life, the time of your many lives. So those, that's the Anapanasati. And of course, I added a lot there, but the most important thing is you see here's the experience of the limiter, you breathe in that, you bite big joy from the limiter, still the limiter, you get joy beforehand, and the piti sukha as you breathe in and out. This is a joyful meditation. It's fun. Why do I spend 45 years being a monk? So, what do you do that for, Ajahn Brahm? Aren't you bored after 45? Don't you want to do something else with your life? Even though I'm such a stable monk now, I'm not going to do anything else. I don't mind saying these things. I had a lot of fun and games with my hosts. This was the last, February the 14th, I was going through Singapore. And so Angie Monksfield, Angie, and she was going to organize a big talk on Valentine's Day. And so, she knew that, as many people will never become monks. So she just, at the end of the talk, she just asked. One of the things I said there was about the couple who'd been married for so many years. And they're doing well in life, and husband's business was going well. So the husband asked his wife, "It's Valentine's Day tomorrow, darling. What would you like for Valentine's Day?" And she said, "Darling, I've got you. That's all I need." He'd been married long enough to know that's not what she really meant. So, "No, come on, something special, I can afford it." And so she looked at him and said, "Diamonds." "Something with diamonds in it, anything with diamonds in it." And he looked at her and said, "Okay, darling." And the following day, Valentine's Day, he presented her with this beautifully wrapped package. "Happy Valentine's Day, darling." And she opened it with so much expectation. And when she opened the package, inside was a pack of playing cards. It had 13 diamonds in it. I couldn't have said, but anyway, at that talk, at the end, Andy knew there was a lot of people, that they were afraid of approaching people they liked, and boys and girls were just too afraid of rejection. So she decided to say, "Okay, put your hand up in this hall, anyone who's single. Who's available?" Now, first of all, single, first of all. And single and available. And of course, I have to be honest, I was single. And she glared at me and said, but you're not available, put your hand down. I said, no. We have lots of fun being a monk. But anyway, because, you know, you have beautiful joy and happiness in meditating. Sitting down there and just blissing out. Oh, that's really nice. Anyway, meditation is for enjoyment. It has wonderful side effects, which maybe talk about another time. Just happiness, health, bliss, energy. Ooh, it's all good stuff. Okay, this Senpai, we should... Any questions now, or shall we just wait till this evening? This evening? Okay, yeah. So, anyone, any questions, especially on what we talk about now, you can put the questions in the box, and then we can... I can answer them this evening. Sadhu! 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 Very good. And of course you don't need to wait for me when you go outside. So you have my full permission.